it's a big ask when someone comes on at 9 o'clock and everyone's been out partying till like 4 in the morning. But I don't think I could have asked for anyone better to start off the morning to attract you in. Some of you might have already concluded from the previous 2 days that I have a very good friend, Brendan Dawes, who we are in constant contact, almost like lovers. And Brendan is really kind that he kind of opens doors and opens my eyes to people that I'm kind of aware of on the periphery but I don't know too well. And our next speaker is someone that Brendan did that with. As soon as Brendan said, "Yeah, you really got to get this tight, he's one of the original anti-rock teams," I went, "What? No way, who can get it?" And he went, yeah, he's a good friend, and I'm sure he'll do it, I'll give you the details." So I contacted Andy, and he was really gracious and said immediately, "Yeah, I'd love to come and do it." So I'm really, really stoked, because, in fact, we were just talking. Can I just have a show of hands, who has heard of anti-rock? Well, that's great. So we figured that there's going to be a split in the audience. There's going to be the young dudes that have just been in Flash recently, and there's going to be the old guys like me, and obviously you, that have heard of Antiron. For those of you that haven't heard of Antiron, Brendan calls them the Sex Pistols of multimedia. They were the guys that started all this shit that we do now. And everything you've seen over the last 2 days was awesome stuff. It all started from there. So you have an absolutely fantastic time ahead of you with Andy here. Will you please welcome to the stage, Andy Blake. Thank you.
That's quite a hard introduction to follow up. Maybe I should just come forward and spit on the audience or something. That's all right. I've been just thoroughly impressed over the last few days here. Been to quite a few conferences, and first of all, this is certainly the best one that I've ever been to in terms of being taken care of. I've never seen the audience also taken care of so well, and it's so well organised. So, but I've also had the sort of inspiring and thoroughly depressing experience of just seeing stuff like Robert Stuff last night and Eric's, just thinking, I'll just get my coat and leave. Because it's kind of, it's amazing to see what those guys are doing. And I feel a bit of an imposter in a way, because most of the stuff I'm going to show you is 14 years old now, or in between, so 14 and 10 years old. And it's all in Director, pretty much. And the Adobe guys will remember Director. One day, the guy in the broom cupboard at Adobe is going to finish the next version of it. And what was interesting for me is Pixels. You Flash guys have discovered Pixels. It's been really nice to see. Because that was the whole thing with Director. It's bitmap-based, mainly, until sort of more recently. And we all came from, in Antiron, from a background in the photography, film, video, sculpture. I think it was one of us who was trained as a graphic designer, and even then he was a painter, really. And we didn't really know what we were doing. And the revolution for us was Director. Version 3, I think when it hit. Because there was a whole bunch of people who previously couldn't code or didn't know how to do any of this stuff, who were suddenly allowed to actually make some interactive stuff. And I was fixing up some old code, resurrected the old movies last night, and I was looking through the code that we'd written all those years ago, in 1993 or something. And it's awful. I mean, it's terrible. But part of the thing is that we just had a go, and there are quite a few of the speakers have been talking about, and then there's this weird tension going on. On one hand, Flash is becoming this incredible sort of piece of software, an amazing amount of power. Clearly, it can be a huge solution to a very big project. So, that's fantastic. It's also a bit of a wall sometimes. And one of the things that we're always really doing is playing a lot, and exploring ideas, exploring interactivity for its own right. Because this, all that time ago, what multimedia was CD-ROMs that were encyclopedias, and it was basically click here to play this video, and you click the button and it played the video, and it was just really fucking boring, and we didn't really want to do any of that, so we wanted to explore what you could do. So I'm going to show you some of that journey in this sort of iterative design approach. I'm a bit of a sort of mix of different things now, and whenever my sort of mum says, what do you actually do for a living, this is the only pie chart on the in the presentation. It's the easiest way of trying to describe who I am. So I do a kind of mix of stuff. I'm a writer and an academic. I teach. And sometimes I do artistic stuff, kind of. Hang on, I've just got a cough. Oh, that was... Sorry, I made that louder. And I find that it's really hard to separate those two out. I've tried quite hard to think, okay, right, I really should just knuckle down and be an interaction designer. I should really just concentrate on being a writer. And I can't, because they feed into each other. And I'll talk a little bit later about writing in relationship to anything digital, actually. There's a factory... Sorry, hang on a second. Can you guys just turn my mic down just for like a second? Thanks. I would spare you that. It's the Crayola factory in the States, and I don't know who's used Crayola crayons in here as a kid. Now you probably, like me, remember that sort of waxy feeling and the little snap sound as you take the crayon away from the paper. It's got this really nice kind of tactile quality to it. I found out that the average kid, by the time they're 10 years old, has worn down 730 crayons, and they spend 28 minutes a day doing that stuff. And amazingly, these guys make 12 million crayons a day. And it just stunned me when I read that, because it shows how fundamental playing and making marks and that kind of very tactile quality. They also make silly putty, by the way, 9 million of those a day. And there's a really good book, and I forgot to put the slide up of it. There's a book called Timeless Toys by a guy called Chris Walsh. And he basically goes through things like Slinky and Monopoly and Silly Putty, and he talks about the history of them. And what comes through, apart from, of course, the actual experience of playing these, is playful. The process of those things being created is really playful, too. You know, the Silly Putty was this stuff that was a company, that was, I can't remember what they manufactured, but they came up with this sort of funny, rubbery stuff that was sort of like a solid, sort of like a liquid, really bounced, and said to a guy, we don't know what to do with this. Can you think of anything? And he took it home, was playing with it, sort of got it out when his friends came around, and they all, oh, this is really fun. And his kids, of course, are playing with it. And he could see that something there was valuable, and it took ages for them to actually market it. Because, of course, people go, yeah, well, I'm like Parker Brothers, for example, with Monopoly. I said, yeah, you know, all the executives played it and stuff. I said, yeah, it's an interesting game, but we don't really see a market for it. And in this time after time after time, you get those situations where someone's playing with something, they can tell that there's something new, but the kind of commercial guys take quite a long time to catch up with it. And that's largely the story, I guess, of the stuff that we'd been doing. And I think some of the last few speakers that we've seen over the week, the last few days, have really talked about that a lot. And I can't emphasize this enough. There's two aspects to interactivity that I'm really interested in. One is playfulness as an approach. Anti-ROM was a flat structure. We were friends with and shared, or still are friends with and shared, offices with Tomato, who are a design, creative collective, I'd say. and they had a completely flat structure. And we just shared stuff all the time. We shared our code. It was a real sort of pass the parcel. And we deliberately, you know, someone might be quite good at coding, someone might be quite good at graphics, but we deliberately cross-wired that when we could. When we had sort of work, when we were working on projects that weren't, you know, really critical in terms of timelines, we'd make sure the coders did graphics and the graphics guys did code. in order to have that sort of cross experience, because doing stuff wrong is often a really great way of discovering something new. But the other thing is that I got really interested as a writer about sort of structure and story structure and things, and that someone can say to you, well, you know, if you do this, this and this, then you've got an interesting story, and if you don't, it's going to be really dull. And of course, we've been telling stories for thousands of years, but when it comes to interactivity, it's still a bit experimental, still a bit hit and miss. It's very young as a form, and trying to work out what engages people, you know, sometimes you can spend ages working on something and it's really dull. You know, it's technically brilliant, it's graphically brilliant, it's just boring as an interactive piece. And then you can knock something up in an afternoon and everyone's just, you know, hanging around the computer having a go. And I'm really interested in why that is. And my opinion is it's when they make people play. So my whole thing's been about trying to waste people's time, really, as much as I can. This is just the Crayola factory. I just like it. The nice colours. And that's the machine that packs the little packets and everything. So, then we met these. This is where the brand managers have a heart attack. This is Photoshop 1.07. And this was the only early Macromedia logo I could find, actually. It was Macromind in those days, so I didn't find. Now with Web 2 Reflections. And all of a sudden, there were these two tools, you know, no layers, I forget all that stuff in Photoshop. But these two tools that allowed us to manipulate images and to mess around with interactive stuff. And that's the sort of Sex Pistols bit, I suppose, in the sense that it was really that idea of, well, now we've got the tools, we can just kind of, anyone can have a go at this, and trying to just work out and push the limits of what you can do. Why is that not going on? There we go. I'm really sorry about this frog in my throat. It makes everyone else do it as well. Like everyone go. All right. So Antiron was very playful. It was interactive and it was iterative as well. We did masses of shit. We kind of made lots of bad stuff. And we had this sort of manifesto, really, to make as many mistakes, rather than sort of try and work everything out and plan it perfectly and then get it right first off. We just tried to make as many mistakes as we could, as quickly as we could, because to try and find the interesting stuff. And so we had this very iterative process where we'd come up with something simple, come up with something else simple, sort of breed them together, see what came out of it, and then keep rebreeding those. And we'd just pass the stuff around, and sometimes a piece of code would inspire a graphic approach, sometimes a graphic approach or some images or something would someone go, ah, you know what, we could code this. I was talking to Brendan, a thing I never made in the end, actually. On the original Antirom CD, I had this idea for a fridge with a load of food in it, and if you kept putting the CD in and playing it, the fridge sort of stayed fresh. And if you just left it on your shelf for ages, the next time you put it in, everything had just gone off and mouldy in the inside. So the idea from that came from, I don't know, a picture of a fridge or something. It didn't, I can't remember why I didn't do it. Just one of the many things. Brilliant, fantastic ideas I never got around to making. We also had this sort of art and interaction design blur. And that was quite important for us as well, that We didn't really make much distinction between our commercial work and our interactive work and our sort of artwork. And I sort of still don't. I still find it very hard to separate those two. And, you know, whenever I interview designers, I'm always really interested in what I call the sort of gold in the shoebox under the bed. That quite often I've sort of interviewed designers for jobs and they've said, yeah, here's the stuff I've done. And, you know, they just show me everything else that everyone's done. And they go, okay, so what are you good at? Yeah, I'm really great at Photoshop. Well, you know, I'm good at pencils. They're tools, you know, and in some respects, you could call this pencil on the beach or paintbrush on the beach. When you think of it that way, it's kind of doesn't make so much sense to really focus on a tool. And I really think John's done a fantastic job of bringing in a real mix of different people. You need to know your tools, and you need to kind of be able to get deeply into them. And anyone who saw Mario's talk, he just, you know, just knew this stuff inside out in a way that I will never understand. But at the same time, you also need to play and remember that they are tools. This was a piece. I might show you this actually, or a bit of it. This was a piece we did. Oh, there we go. Right. I thought that mouse was my mouse. Screen grabbed mouse. This was a piece we did for the Barbican. They had a big exhibition, which was billed as a walk-in magazine. And it was sort of a load of interactive stuff, people from sort of days that can be used there and all sorts of other stuff. And we had this 9-screen video wall, and we separated off the column of screens where those film strips are on one side. And they were the kind of sound toys, and then you could sort of edit this video stuff on the other screens. But each one was in its own TV. It was a TV video wall. So I'm just going to drop out of here and show you some stuff. Oh, I'm going to show you something really early. It's one of the really earliest things we did in terms of randomness, and I just still quite like it, so I'm going to show you, because it's quite funny still. Look at that. We all worked on a project called the Virtual Nightclub, and it was, it was a virtual nightclub. You wandered around this 3D space with poster-boarded kind of 3D characters standing there like that. I don't know about you, but the reason for going to a nightclub is usually the people. And the music, and it was just really tedious, and that's an accident actually. So this is just random text thing. And I'd still enjoy the randomness. A lot of what we explored was randomness. Now, at the beginnings of this was before the web, and then of course when the web happened, randomness on a really slow connection wasn't done. You know, you really need to make sure that people know what they're about to download before they do it. So we had to kind of pull back from a lot of this if we ever did much web stuff, which we didn't actually. But randomness was really key because it's very playful. You come up with this stuff all the time. The first Anti-ROM CD just had this completely random interface. We originally thought, okay, we'll have a home screen and everything, and then we said, no, let's have more than one home screen. And then we said, no, let's just have every time you click, you go onto something else randomly. And there were about 60 or 70 pieces of work in it. And you, because randomness wasn't really random, you'd get a kind of 10 of them over and over, and you think, oh, okay, I've seen everything now. And then just as you're about to quit, you'd get kind of one more. I don't know how much is in here. And that open-endedness, a bit like what Hillman was talking about in terms of constructing a short film or a scene, was really important. That just kept people going at it. And a friend of ours who was quite a sort of straight guy, actually, and we thought he wouldn't really like this, he said, I keep playing Anti-ROM. I can't stop playing, and I really need to do some work. And that was, for us, a sort of fantastic sort of feedback. Can't beat randomness. Good. Right. So that thing I showed you, the Barbican thing, we did quite a lot of stuff. Here's a particle generator that we wrote back in 96. It's not, in fact. It's just the particle generator is an ink cartridge with a hole in it being dropped into an ashtray, a clear ashtray with water in it. And I'll show you this, partly because I quite like it still. Because I think it's quite beautiful. But also because it's got really very simple code. It's got nothing to do with doing particle stuff and things, which I like. I mean, I write those things too. I just think it's really interesting. You spend all this effort making something in code, and quite often it's just a lot easier to go and get a camera, stick it over an ashtray, and video some stuff. So a lot of the Anti-ROM things had this iterative process I talked about, and this is a really early one, and I've resurrected this a while ago. I'm just going to hit the sound off here. This is one of the pieces from a whole, you know, this 60 or 70. This is one that Sophie Pendrell did. There were 10 or 11 of us in Anti-ROM towards the end. And she said, wouldn't it be interesting, now you have to remember this is 1993, okay, wouldn't it be interesting if we had like a wraparound set of screens, so you had 9 screens in a grid, and every time you came to the bottom, you went round to the top again, which is what this is, okay. And this uses just one of what directors built in sort of shift transitions. It doesn't do anything smooth. And then the question is, well, what content do we put in? and this is the content. And I always imagined sort of George Bush Senior, as it was then, cigar in the Oval Office, deck chair with some sand, going, where am I going to bomb today? And so what you do is you roll the mouse around, and in certain places there's little hot spots where you can bomb little Pacific islands and stuff, where terrorists are and things. And so that was that, and it's a very, fairly sort of simple interface, and fairly simple, still kind of quite amusing. And then we had this thing, said, well, you know, what would happen if you actually made that sort of smooth scrolling? And so we made a kind of smooth scroller, and the piece here, this was a thing we did for MTV, 95, I think, 94, maybe. And so this smoothly scrolls. I can't show you this, actually, because I don't have the code anymore. But this was also panels that smoothly scrolling around, and as you rolled near these elements, we just shot some stuff in the studio, and they kind of had little animations. And the idea was to have this sort of organic ident. You know what Robert was saying when he gave the stuff to Nando, it gave him a system to kind of then work on and dump out the stuff he needed. That was the idea to MTV. And so here you go, run this on the computer and cut to it when you need it. But they didn't really get that, so they dumped it to tape. But even so, it was kind of an interesting idea at the time. Did I just quit? No, good. So then we said, well, what would happen if we got a bit of Super 8 and put it on a scanner? And don't do this, it's really tedious to scan a long piece of Super 8. Because you have to sort of put it diagonally and then straighten it up. It never matches up. And, you know, have it scrolling up and down because you'd see all the frames and that'd be kind of nice. So this, again, this was 94, I think, 95 maybe. And so here he is. Here's someone's toes. Why not? In front of a swimming pool. And there's a sound loop that's pitching. There's one that's staying. No, the sound loop is pitching up and down. This one. And quite by accident, we realised we had sort of rediscovered film projectors or a zoetrope, because as you make it go fast enough, it will just animate. I still kind of quite like that. But now, this stuff I'm doing there at the moment, where I'm just playing around, it's kind of much, much more interesting to be here and do this stuff than it is to look at it. And one of the things about it is the sort of physical nature of the interaction. And I'll sort of come to it again later on. But the sort of little movements that make how it makes you play is a really fundamental part, I think, to it being an engaging piece. So then we went on and said, okay, we'll break all of those sort of panels apart and imagine we'll have sort of separate panels and they're all scrolling around and we'll attach sounds to them. Because one of the things we also did was this. Just turn that off a sec. Everyone was making kind of like 3D mixes with 3D sliders and doing sort of sound mixes like that. And so you press a button in real life, press a fake one on the screen to then make something happen. And it seemed to us just a whole layer that was ridiculous in the middle there that got in the way. And we wanted to make a sound mixer that wasn't like that, that you actually just interacted directly with the content. And this is all stuff also just put on the scanner directly. And each one of these has a sound attached to it, and as the mouse goes closer to it, you know, the sound mixes up. But that means you can create a little soundscape. So I'll just... Okay, there you go, that's that. So that was in 1993, I think we made that. It was kind of, and it was just really interesting to explore these ideas at the time. Going, oh, you know. And then we sort of put all these things together, and this is a, we were really lucky to be friends with Underworld because they're part of Tomato, and they kind of said you can use any of our music until they changed record company, and then that got a bit more tricky. So we took an Underworld track and chopped some loops out of it. Each one of these now has a its own sort of space, its own movement in relation to the mouse, and it has a sound attached to it. So I'll just kind of play it. So you've got this kind of background thing. And that one's quite quiet, it's fine enough. And you can pick them up and drag them and hang on to them if you like. Okay, that one's quite clear. You can hear the kind of sound mixes up. And we can kind of put that one over there and mix them in a bit. We'll let it go again, and there it goes on. We'll just sort of go a bit bonkers with it. So that was, I don't know, ages ago, 96 or something, I think it was. And again, this idea of gradually sort of iterating things, but that's still a period of about sort of 3 years. What I haven't shown is all the shit in between, all the really ones that didn't work very well and all of that kind of stuff. But there were loads and loads and loads of those. And then we kind of combined these things together and made that. And let's see where I am on the main thing here. Okay, so we did quite a lot of work for Levi's, and they were great in terms of coming to us and saying, do what you want, and stick some of our stuff in there occasionally. And they weren't very heavy with the branding either. So here's the thing we did for Choose Fun. I'm not going to show you. This is a little sound sequencer. I'm going to show you a slightly different one later. And it was sort of semi-random. You could sort of store some of the random things along the bottom here. And we just played around. We got one of our mates to dress up in a gorilla suit and filmed him in the studio. That was great. So this, we had a sort of kiosk that we're doing. But again, this thing where we're trying to work with directly interacting with the content. So they had a whole video about, you know, this is how jeans get made, and it was just really boring. Whereas this one was an interactive thing. We could roll a bit closer. You roll closer to the dye bath, and all the bubbles bubble, and the sound comes up and stuff. And we started to do two things that sort of came in tandem. One was a performance, which. Yeah, I might show you. Embarrassingly, it's on YouTube actually. And one is this interactive shop windows, and these are capacitance sensors, so they work through glass. And this is like sort of bulletproof glass or bandit-proof glass, it's called. So people can whack it really hard and not damage your stuff. And this was a plasma. This was a really early plasma screen. I think it was 96 or 97. And this was like 20 grand. This plasma screen. And this was in a shopping centre. It was also in Manchester. It was also on Regent Street in London for a bit. And we had started doing some performance stuff. That one, that piece I just showed you, had started doing sort of VJ, DJ stuff in clubs. And realised how important it was that stuff worked straight away. And when you're walking along with your mates and you kind of go up to an interactive shop window, if it doesn't work, you look stupid. And you've been the one who's been bold enough to go up there and have a go. And so we realised from our own performance that the physical aspect to it and the performative aspect to it was really important to remember. But it was also a really good discipline. People have been talking about these limitations. We had this grid of 9 buttons, basically, and we lined them up with a sort of grid on the screen of 9. And then everything you think of is like, well, what can we do in this grid of 9? That's really hard. So here's a little bit of other stuff. The problem with working in kind of multimedia or new media for a long time is that nothing works. No, old stuff doesn't work anymore. Even a whole load of video that I had was on a special hardware codec and compressed, and I can't get that anymore either. So I've just got used to the fact that this stuff dies and goes. And I read about people who write haikus and the sort of haiku masters, when they wrote a particularly good haiku, they'd put it in a bottle and throw it into the ocean so that no one ever read it, as a way of kind of letting go of their ego or something. Maybe they're just stupid. Okay. This guy here is just a guy who happens to be wandering past whilst we were videoing it. So.
Yeah.
little story about Flat Eric in a minute. Oh, there's an interesting little one. I'm just going to stop that there. Maybe I'm not going to stop that there. Stop that there. There was a little aside there, actually. There's those models who are kind of going around in 3D. We kind of thought about this and what should we do, some quick kind of art thing. And in the end, we just had some models stand really still, and we put them on turntable against a sort of white studio and just video them, and then it was much, much easier. But it was a nice way of looking at the jeans. Except all the Levi's guys going, I don't know if you can see the thread texture on that. It's fucking 8-bit. Oh yeah, Flat Eric, the little puppet. Who knows Flat Eric in here? It was quite a big campaign. Yes. Yeah, I went off to Australia after he sort of got to his height. But we had this great thing once. We said to Levi, said, "Can we video Flat Eric?" And they said, "Yeah." And they rang up Henson's Creature Shop in Macon, you know, the Muppet people. And we said, "Yeah, we'd like a Flat Eric Muppet. He's not a Muppet. He's a puppet. Only puppets on the Muppet Show." A Muppet, okay. And they said, okay, yeah, could we have, yes, would you like a puppeteer? And we kind of, how much is it? Oh, it's another, you know, 700 quid. No, we'd do it ourselves. So anyway, he came with a minder. This woman just sat in the corner all day. And there's two versions of him in a flight case, one with sort of stiff arms that you could move and one with sort of arms on sticks. And I've had my hand inside Flat Eric. It was great. It was just really good fun. It was to play around with him. And we used to have a sort of just a cellar in the tomato building. And it was great because it was a dark space. You could sort out the lighting and just go down and sort of shoot some stuff and did all these silly things with Flat Eric. Out of all of that came we were making all these sound toys, of which one I just showed you. And I'll show you another one in a second. And we became really interested in performing these. We all basically wanted to be kind of, you know, multimedia rock stars or something. And we started doing that, but this was kind of what a typical performance was like for the audience. But basically kind of three guys behind laptops. And it wasn't very interesting. And having worked on this stuff with sensors, we thought, well, let's kind of perform it. And this is really embarrassing to show, actually. I'm going to show you. I think the YouTube thing's... I've got it somewhere here. Yeah. I'll show you this. It's really compressed to hell. So I'm sorry about that. And I might stop it before it gets too embarrassing. Here's us getting away from the computer and jumping around on pressure pads on the stage. And all the audio and the visuals of what you're seeing, very simple, but they're all being triggered by everything we're doing. And it was really important to us, actually, to put the mouse back on the screen. When we first did it, everyone thought we were just playing video. And then we were like, no, we were making all that interactive stuff. Didn't you see how cool we were? And actually putting the mouse back on the screen and putting that interface back on the screen, weirdly, got people to understand what we were doing. This is, I think, at 1.0 Festival. And this is just three white guys who can't dance, basically. I'll show you. RGB, get it? Look at us, it's terrible, isn't it? I don't know if I can show you much more. I'll move on to this bit. There's a classic bit in a minute from me. I had to play the drums, basically. There you go, that's me doing two drum beats at the same time. The rest of it, though, is fantastic. There's another one on YouTube, which is a little less embarrassing. The point was, then, about kind of 4 or 5 years later, so walk past amusement arcade, and I thought, fucking hell, Dance Dance Revolution, and there's this kind of Japanese kid there. Really kind of cool. Massive crowd around me. Got to the end, finished, and then just went. Didn't even sort of trigger that he'd impressed all these people. But it was also, it's interesting for me to see that happen as well, because we've been seeing quite a lot of camera interactive stuff and things. And it's been great to see things like Wii and iToy suddenly sort of become much more pervasive in people's houses.
But the physical part of the interaction, I mean, again, you know, we're sort of really getting into that, even though we're all sort of standing there going. It's much more engaging to actually be the one doing it than clearly it was to do that, to actually watch that particular performance. We got a bit better at it later on. Now, where am I? Oh, okay, this is just I did a brief stint at Razorfish. I don't know if Martin's in here. Is he? Yeah. I just wanted to try and make banking a bit less boring. And they had this savings tool, and it was just like a JavaScript calculator, and it was just fucking dull. And I just said to the guys, you know, you're never going to get anyone to save any money like that. You know, saving money is all about kind of trying to balance your life. And so we did this little thing where you could lock off bits of your... I don't know where my mouse has gone, actually. Oh, here. You could lock off things and go, well, this is how much I have to spend on transport every day, and then move the others up and down. And then if you pushed that food really high, so I've got some big... Oh, my home is a castle here. All the others just kind of move down again, so you have to sort of balance this thing. And you get this little sort of power bar thing. Because I just feel that there's a lot of things... We get a lot of stuff every day, a lot of information every day, and things that are slightly playful, things that are slightly witty, make you smile, they make you think, well, that was nice, someone's thought about that, in a way that, you know, so many dry things don't. You just think, oh, same old again. And I don't believe that everything that's kind of serious, like your money or something, has to really be presented seriously all the time. I wouldn't want to have... you know, a huge skip intro screen before I get into my account balance. But at the same time, I wouldn't mind if someone wrote some quite witty copy or something, you know, when my account was overdrawn, instead of saying, you know, you're going to have to pay £50 million in fees, you know, if they had a little kind of ticked me off in some way, and I've been out on the tiles again or something. I'd find that quite funny from a bank, personally. Anyway, Martin was programming it, and... taught me the value. This was really hard to do. Well, it was impossible to do skewed shapes. I know you Flash guys probably going, in Director in these days, it was impossible to do those kinds of skewed shapes. Didn't have any quads or corners or vertices or anything. And really taught me the value of just making it work for the person using it. Because I said to him, oh God, how did you do that then? He said, well, no, it's just a cut-out shape with a hole in the middle and there's a rectangle going up and down behind it. I was like, of course. And the moral of the story, and I always tell my students this, is that sometimes you can spend ages sitting down and going, okay, I'm going to code this now. What's the best way? What's going to be the most brilliant, elegant way of coding it? And you spend hours and hours doing that, and then it screws up anyway. And you have to go, oh, no, I'm going to do a little hack here. I wouldn't. Oh, God, no. And actually, sometimes, just getting it done is the important thing. And if, especially if you don't really have to share it with anyone else, making it work is the important thing. And especially when you're doing those kinds of sketches that you know, Brendan was showing too. Oh, actually, there's something I wanted to show you. I wanted to do a little bit of the performance. Here's a piece called a sound sequencer. It's called Mr. Dan, that's what the music is. And again, something I wrote ages ago, kind of 94 or something. It was interesting trying to build a little sound sequencer. And I don't know whose code this is now. We shared it and passed it around and modified it so much that as a sort of group. All of this stuff is really collective work. And I've been really lucky to work with some people far more brilliant than I am. And really great to work with. And it all just gets kind of munged together. So I'm sort of wanting to take you through the approach. So this is the thing. We got Nick Roop, who, as some of you might know, is the one of the directors of Poke in London now. He's one of Enterom, and he was just dancing around in front of the screen once when we were shooting some Levi's stuff. So, and I think this is a girl, in fact. No, this isn't Nick. Sorry, he doesn't have a figure like that. This was one of the models we had for Levi's stuff, and we said, oh, yeah, the Levi's guys have gone for coffee. Could you just dance around a bit in front of the camera for us? And so she did. So this is a little sound sequencer, and this is one of the things we used to perform. How are we doing for time? Okay, I'm going to... I'll go on. There's another one thing I'll show you, actually. Another couple of those, because I kind of like them. Here's one called... this one's called Silver Key. There's actually another one called, beautifully titled Piss Cubes, because there was some stuff that Tomato done for Orange, I think, and they had this Perspex box with orange liquid in, piss cubes. And I can't find that one anymore. But we did another one, and this was it was the first sort of 3D stuff, and it was before a director did 3D, and it was actually before a director had any Z-planing either, index. So it was a real bastard to do, and I didn't write the code for this. Andy Allenson did, I think. Again, the graphics of it, because it's all photographic, just got Nick, I think, actually got a piece of paper and just filmed it, really, or just took photographs of it, or filmed it and moved it around a bit. And we just put all those things together. And there's a guy called Nick Ryan who did the music for this. And I don't know if I can remember what all the keys are, but I'll give it a go. I'll show you two more. This is again using Underworld stuff. Oops, just ruined it there for you. We didn't really know 3D, but we did kind of know how to make a ball in 3D, and this is just a wireframe ball or just blurred up. But again, this is all rendered out as little kind of pits. It's not being made in real time or anything. Hang on. And so. This is just a quick time track with several tracks in it, and you just turn them on and off. That was the only way we really knew how to make a mixer at the time that was really going to stay in sync.
Thank you.
one of my favourite tunes in the world. And so with all the kind of all the stuff, I'll just quickly show you this whilst I'm talking actually. We had a little sort of title sequence, and I don't know where this came from. There was a CD or a DVD you could get, CD it must have been, with had all these kind of movies of explosions and stuff on it for doing post-production. And so we just kind of used some of these to, if I get this right. No, it's not working now, of course. Well, there you go. It was great. And it's just a video, well, it's just a sequence of stills, I think, doing it. And again, it's this idea that sometimes the low-tech route is a really fantastic way to go, rather than thinking, oh, how am I going to render for like flames and everything and do it all in kind of particles? And sometimes, you know, real flames look a lot nicer. So we spent quite a lot of time doing those kind of organic things where we were filming stuff and videoing stuff. And that's kind of stuck with me ever since. I'm not really a designer, actually. I'm an interaction person and writer more now. And none of us were ever really graphic designers. We did what we needed, we had a photograph and stuff and sand stuff and things like that. But what we quite liked about it is we always did it in a different field. One of the dangers, I guess, with everyone using the same tools is that everything looks the same. And when you're up against the deadline, you fall back on the stuff that's easy to do. And you fall back on the filters that kind of easy to do. The stuff that the software does as well. And the challenging way of worth trying to short circuit that. And again, that's why playing with it is really interesting. What was amazing about Tomato, for example, is that they were just rubbish with their computers. Constantly getting phone calls from them. Can't find it, the best one. These guys are fantastic designers, so I kind of hold in really high regard. And the guy is going, I'm going to save it, and it's gone somewhere. On the other hand, I go up to him and go, see this whole thing at time, do you know what this is? And then I think it's great. I'm going out looking at the book, we're right. I'm just going, it's true, man. So they just had for them, the computers were tools. You know, and a lot of the stuff they did, they had a broken fax machine that left lines up the page. And a lot of that stuff they're famous for in the kind of early 90s about the sort of degraded type and stuff. Also, I don't know if Neville Brody's in here at the moment, but he was also a large part of. Tomato did a lot of that stuff because their fax machine was broken, and they went, oh, that's quite nice, and then started putting their stuff through the fax machine and then scanning in. I then went to Australia after the Razorfish, and I went to Australia kind of for a holiday actually, and to get a tan, which hasn't stayed. And I stayed there for 7 years, and that's one of the reasons why I haven't been over here much. And I went to set up the interactive department of a company called Animal Logic. And if you've seen Happy Feet, they were the guys who did all the animation of that, and they did quite a lot of stuff for The Matrix, and they were the Corridors of Code guys and all of that stuff. And I went there to set up the interactive department, and again, I sort of wanted to make a little anteroom within inside a kind of larger infrastructure. And it didn't really... Well, the dot-com crash happened, really, and it was sort of just a terrible time for everyone. But one of the things that we spent an inordinate amount of time on was our own website. Now, this doesn't actually work very well now, which annoyingly. Let me go back there a second. And I'm not quite sure why. I've got a copy of it locally, and it's not working, and Safari was crashing on me earlier. The DHTML doesn't work. So this was about 2000, 2001. It was the first time the coder said to me, oh, this thing called Stylesheets I want to use. So we started using CSS. And again, we didn't want to make a kind of corporate site. We didn't want to make, for Animal Logic, there's, you know, film and TV people look at their website. And so the audience for people who've got money, they've got bandwidth, and they want a rich visual experience. And so we had this whole idea that the whole of Animal Logic was just sort of inside a little chemistry set. And we had a really long brainstorming process for this, actually, where everyone kind of brought together ideas, and we came up with this whole look for it. Sorry, excuse my language there. That was I need to turn MAMP on. Okay. There we go. Yeah. And everything you can kind of play with. So this is Moulin Rouge. They did the stuff for Moulin Rouge. And we had a lot... this isn't working. It's not right. Here should be a little animation of code going up and down and thing. I seem to be on the non-Flash version. Now, unfortunately, changed their website, and I forgot to bring the proper version I've got of this with me. They changed it about kind of 4 months ago, and I thought I'll just go online and show you. But there were lots of little kind of gags in here. I'm going to really quickly go through it. This bit I like. This is just sort of about the people. And my friend Steve Scott is a brilliant illustrator who I hired, and he's now in London, actually. Hire him. stevescott.com.au. He's really fantastic. He was just doodling all the time. I think somewhere there's me. I think that was meant to be me. And this is the key people. So this is the really the most corporate part of the site, if you like. And we managed to... So this is RA, who's the managing director. Bruce Carter, creative director. And Steve managed to kind of sneak in... This guy smoking a spliff at the bottom of the kind of corporate part of the site. And I really liked the sort of playfulness of the whole thing. Okay, I can kill off MAMP now. I think that's enough from there. Okay. How are we doing? All right. And we did quite a lot of experimental work as well, but I'm going to skip over that. Oh, we did a DVD, which was the chemistry set, so that when you got it, you got the DVD, which is their showreel, but you also got this little... this little thing here, this little packet of experiments you could make. So we had a crowd replicator, and it was a balloon. You cut out all these little paper men and get the balloon and rub it on your jumper, and they all stand up like that on the ground. So. And we had a rocket as well, actually, on a string. And so, it's, again, you know, just constantly trying to have that playful approach that, you know, you get sent a showreel every time. Of course, the showreel might be brilliant, but, you know, it's in a DVD case. Oh, I love the showreel. This was something we hoped, you know, people go, oh, that's nice, I'm going to keep that on my desk, or go, hey, look at this. And that's really a large part of everything. It's like, I want to stop people in their workflow and get people to go, oh, you know, look at this thing, I've been playing with this for the last 5 minutes, 2 hours, whatever. That's the playfulness. Oh, I'll skip over that, some other stuff. Yeah, okay. I did some work with Pope that I'm not going to show you just now, because I want to talk about writing very briefly. One of the nice things about writing is it's slow. You can't do it quickly. And John Warwicker from Tomato said to me once, you know, I used to quite like slow computers, because when the rendering bar was going, I used to be able to think about what I wanted to do. And then, you know, I'd then go, oh, yeah, okay, I think I'm going to do that differently. And as stuff got quicker and quicker and quicker, you kind of got less of that downtime to just kind of think about stuff. I don't know, you know, it's just the total opposite from Bradley, who's up here going, oh, I really like to work fast and stuff. I kind of hate it, actually. I really like the time to think about stuff and let it brew. And so writing is something I do, and it's a really good process in terms of having to edit, and it's really good in the sense that you have to do it slowly. You can't do a second draft until you've done the first draft, and that just takes time. You have to sit and write the stuff, and it's a really good discipline to get into as well, actually. It's just take some time out and think about stuff. And actually, I've learned more about sort of creative process through writing than I ever have through doing any design work. So I do some teaching as well, and I'm going to kind of skip through this. This is a getting my students to do a sort of playfulness of everyday things. So this is a table. Here's a this is a little, you know, divider between two desks, and they have these pins that go either way, so you can kind of push little messages to your cubicle mate on the other side. Fuck you. This was a girl who made bags out of vinyl and put polystyrene balls inside. So as it got all static, they kind of your bag and your clothes basically change over the course of the day. And at the beginning of the day, you shake it out, your jacket, and then it all comes to the bottom at the end. And this was a thing called a karma enhancer. And as you spun the wheel like one of those Tibetan prayer wheels, it went online and clicked on all those donation sites. So he saved rainforests and stuff. There's some academic in me is stupidly writing a PhD at the moment about play and interactivity. And I'm just going to talk one little bit of sort of theory. There's a guy called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. who wrote this book about flow. And if you're kind of interested in this, go and take a look at it. And he talked about this, if those of you saw G-Cut doing the VJing and saw his face, he was kind of like, his hands were like this, but his face was, and it was totally in that moment. It was just amazing when he was at the end of Brendan's talk. And he talks about this this threshold of the boundary between boredom and anxiety. That if something's too easy, it's just really boring. And if something's too hard and difficult, it's just too scary and you get anxious and you don't do it. And I think a lot of interaction design is about trying to find that little balance. If it's really tedious, it's just kind of, you know, if it's really easy, it's just really tedious. And yet there's some things that are so opaque, you think, oh, what the fuck's going on here? And oh, just forget it. But there's also this kind of interaction-reaction, action-reaction feedback loop that comes out of that, that you gradually have to kind of ramp up the interaction. I was going to show some of this, and of course then what happened was I made some sort of art pieces that I put in a gallery, and I was really interested in getting people to play. Normally when you go into a gallery, you try it, you time yourself next time you're in a gallery. I stood in front of a Picasso. I thought, I'm going to see if I can spend 2 minutes in front of this painting. And, you know, after 30 seconds, I was going... It's amazing. Normally, you walk around the gallery... And so my thing was, when people are in an exhibition space, and this was in the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, I wanted to get them to sort of mess around. Oh, I'll come back to that. And so that's what this is, and it's another slit scan thing. So I'm just going to show it really quick because everyone's done one of these. But for me, I'd never actually done one that I could interact with. I've seen a lot of images from them, but I hadn't seen them working kind of in the flesh. And so I made one where you could. There was also some other funny stuff going on the right hand side. Let me speed it up a bit. You know, and you do all the stuff that I think Craig was showing. As well, you can. And the main thing was, I'm not really that interested in the pictures. I never save them, actually. They don't get saved out. What I was really interested in is I'd watch people in the gallery and they would kind of go. And then they would just start, and it was great. You know, get some old guy and sort of walk past, and then suddenly you see them For me, the work itself is the interactive experience. It's not actually this stuff. It's not the visual stuff at all. It's the experience that someone's having. And these kids were playing, and they did this, and it was brilliant. I just loved it. And they did some really fantastic stuff. There's some other one where he's got really long hands like this. And so that was, for me, the experience was the most important thing. That playful experience is the most important thing. Now I'm going to really skip on. Things I wish I'd made, that's right. Need I say more? Do you know John Harris? You guys know John Harris? Who knows him in here? So he did some... go and see his stuff. A minute, okay. He's done lots of really great work. There's a piece he did called I Feel Fine. We Feel Fine, sorry, which is brilliant, and it pulls in stuff from blogs. It's done in processing, actually, and it's... I'm going to be another couple of minutes, sorry. And it just scrapes stuff from the blogosphere all over the place, if, of course, I've got an internet connection. Oh, fuck you. Okay. Get offline. Is there anyone online? Here we go, right. And it just pulls in stuff, so... and it's got a really nice interface as well, though. Oh, hang on, let's go back. Can't remember how I go back now. Five feelings, here we go. Because it's sort of quite playful as well, even whilst it's loading stuff and things like this. But it's also really meaningful. It's like being able to kind of see inside everyone's head, because when you click on one of these... Let's find another one. Any sentence where someone says, I feel, he scrapes, and it's like sort of seeing inside everyone's mind. And there's a really nice thing he did here where you can tell how people are feeling. So most people are feeling better, some are feeling bad, a lot of people are feeling good, but I don't really care because I can do that with the mouse, and that's just a really nice bit of interface design on top of the fact he makes really interesting work in itself. So he's a really nice guy, and I absolutely hate him for that, because he's This was really funny, very quickly. He did a thing called word count. And it does the thing of counts how many words, the most used words in the English language. But what's more interesting is you can search for them, and he also gets what everyone searches for instead. So this is sort of more amusing. We're a kind of sophisticated group race, aren't we? And very lastly, there's a piece of work. Oh, I can't show you that. There's a piece of work here. I'll just stop that a second. Do you know this guy, Rafael Lozano Hema? Anyone know him? Good. He's an artist who kind of does incredible sort of media art stuff. And this, I think, works on lots of levels because he gets people to play straight away. What it is a big projection on. You can just see in the background there's figures on the side of a building. It's a really huge scale. But it also then floods them out with. Floods them out with. Shadows or lights at the front, at ground level. And it's a big public square in Berlin and Rotterdam to show this. And there's a whole meaning behind the work. When the shadows line up, the figures move and stuff like that. But what I really like about it is he gets people who've never met each other in a public space to play with each other. I just want to show you this. That little click sound is when people are lining up the shadows. So what happens is he gets people to play and he hooks them in that way because that's the initial response. And then they start learning the interface basically by playing. And then they start connecting with each other and they sort of learn more deeply about the piece. So these sort of multi layers. And I think sometimes when we're thinking, okay, we want to really work this out carefully. And everyone knows what they're doing. Sometimes it's really great, but people don't know what they're doing because there's this invitation to play. And it doesn't matter whether it's, this is quite a sort of corporate website or something, or something that's more artistic and playful. Really need that kind of invitation to play to start with. Because otherwise, there's so much here. You're just never going to get people in. Okay. There's a much longer video of that online. It's really worth checking him out. I really like it. I'm going to leave you with some words of wisdom by people wiser than I. I write 99 pages of shit to one page of masterpiece. Apparently this guy was quite a good writer, Ernest Hemingway. I really like this because it's just really honest that you have to make lots of crap stuff in order to find the good stuff. If you try and only make the good stuff, you don't make anything. I merely took the energy it takes to pout and wrote some blues, which Duke Ellington said. You know, it's all about just doing some stuff and then finding out through play and playing with the tools that you have, playing with the ideas that you have, that you then find out some interesting discoveries. One of the reasons why I called this Playful Revolutions was partly because of Brendan said to me, Anti-Rom was revolutionary, could you come and talk about it? And I kind of said, well, that's a bit of a tall order because I don't really see it that way. But what I've noticed also is revolutions in another sense. A lot of these things coming back round again, a lot of the stuff I've seen has been similar ideas. And it makes me really think that, this is a very young medium. You've got so much opportunity ahead of you. It's kind of really been around for 20 years at push. The kind of stuff we're doing, but most of the other media are much, much older, so there's a huge kind of open vista in front of you, and I just want to encourage you all who are, I'm sure far better coders and developers than I am, to really kind of explore those fringes and not get too kind of wound up in, oh, this is how you should do it, and this is how you should do this, and this is the new version, I need to learn that. Just play, and this is, I really like this. Chance is always powerful. Let your hook always be cast in the pool where you least expect there will be fish. Thank you very much for coming to my talk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. You know, what I like is, I think nowadays people get too hooked up in, I've got to learn the latest thing, I've got to learn the latest thing, how's that class work? You know, looking back at that anti-world stuff, it just goes to show that even in those days when we didn't have all this stuff, it's just about creativity. That's what I enjoy about Andy's thing.